Have you ever looked back at those bold tech and finance predictions from a few years ago and just wondered, did any of that actually happen?
Oh, all the time. I
Yeah.
mean, we constantly fall into this trap of assuming technological elegance is just going to automatically override human behavior.
Right. 3 years ago, the smartest people in finance predicted that by 2030, autonomous AI and blockchain would completely replace human fund managers.
Yeah, a totally frictionless, code-driven future.
We were told we'd all be trading fractional shares of skyscrapers on our phones, you know, and that the old boys club of Wall Street would be rendered obsolete by pristine, bias-free smart contracts.
Which makes for a really fantastic presentation deck.
Yeah.
But markets are made of people, and people are fiercely protective of their leverage.
Exactly. Which brings us to the incredible stack of notes we're doing a deep dive on today. We have our hands on the ARCH 2.0 reality terminal.
Published by ODIT Frontier Partners.
Or OFP.
Right, OFP. Back in 2025, they published ARCH 2030, which was this grand, sweeping diagnostic framework predicting how private capital would entirely restructure itself over the next 5 years, yeah.
But now it's mid-2026. And to their immense credit, they are actually grading their own homework.
Which you rarely see in this industry.
True. They're looking at their 20 big predictions and asking what held up, what completely changed course, and what just, you know, flat out reversed.
And a context here is crucial, because the terminal doesn't just offer a postmortem on bad guesses. It actually provides a real-time map of the global capital system as it functions right now.
Yeah, because when forecasters miss the mark, the way they miss often reveals the hidden mechanics of an industry.
Exactly.
So our mission today is to shortcut you through this incredibly dense financial terminal and pull out the ultimate aha moments.
We're going to look at what they got right and what they got spectacularly wrong.
And how the actual reality of global finance today is often much plainer, but honestly way more fascinating than the sci-fi predictions we were sold. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
We'll start with what OFP calls the overarching pattern of the last year, the great rerouting.
Right. So if you look at the ARCH 2.0 findings at the highest level, the forecasters correctly predicted where the industry was going.
The destinations reached.
Yes, the ultimate destinations largely survived. But they completely missed how the industry would arrive there. The vehicles changed.
Let's ground that in a specific example for everyone listening. The 2025 framework predicted a massive power shift.
It did. It said we would see limited partners, meaning the pension funds and university endowments, actually supplying the money, gaining a lot more power.
More oversight over the general partners, the GPs who actively manage those investment funds.
Exactly. And the prediction was that this would happen through high-tech, protocol-based trust.
Basically, code-governed smart contracts. Like, it would automatically trigger a change in management if a fund started underperforming.
An automated real-time recalibration of power.
Right. But the reality recorded in the terminal shows that while power did shift from GPs to LPs, blockchain protocols had nothing to do with it.
Not a single thing. LPs simply leverage the macroeconomic environment. Money is incredibly tight right now.
So instead of demanding a software engineer rewrite the code of a massive pooled fund, LPs just, well, took their capital and left the pooled funds entirely.
They moved into what the industry calls separate accounts, or funds of one.
Just bypassing the pool completely.
Yeah. In a pooled fund, your money is mixed with 50 other institutions, and you all accept the general partner's standard terms. In a separate account, you are the only investor.
So you make the rules.
Exactly. You dictate the fees, the transparency, the exit timeline. LPs realize that when capital is scarce, the person writing the check does not need a smart contract.
They just needed a bespoke legal agreement. So they reach the destination, more power for the investor, but they use an old school, hard-knuckled negotiation to get there.
And we see this exact same dynamic with retail investors, too.
Oh, yeah, the retail flood. The 2025 prediction was that everyday retail capital, your average person with some savings, would flood into private markets.
Through tokenized vehicles and modular onboarding software.
What's so fascinating here is that retail capital is indeed entering the market rapidly. The floodgates did open.
But again, the right was entirely different. It didn't come through programmable tokenization on a blockchain.
Right. It came through what are known as 40 Act funds and interval funds, which, just to make sure we don't lose anyone in the jargon, what is a 40 Act fund in plain English?
It refers to the Investment Company Act of 1940. It's essentially the regulatory bedrock for mutual funds in the United States.
So very traditional.
Very. These are heavily regulated legacy legal structures designed to protect everyday investors. Historically, they only held publicly traded stocks.
But that changed.
Yeah. Recently, massive legacy players like Blackstone and Brookfield figured out how to package illiquid private assets, like commercial real estate or private debt, inside these familiar 1940 legal wrappers.
Or into interval funds, which are similar but only allow you to withdraw your money at specific predefined intervals.
Right. So basically, the forecasters predicted we'd all be commuting in autonomous flying cars by now.
The reality is, we did get to the office faster, but it's because the government built a new highway and we just took the bus.
I love that. The flying car analogy works perfectly. But let's look closer at that new highway.
The government action.
Yes. If we connect this to the bigger picture, state action and government policy were massively underweighted in the original 2025 predictions.
Totally ignored, almost.
The retail floodgates opened because the U.S. Department of Labor and the SEC formally allowed these alternative assets into standard 401k retirement plans.
So the structural change was driven by regulatory permission, not by design elegance.
Exactly, which leads to a fairly obvious question.
Right. If the blockchain smart contracts didn't revolutionize the rules of the game, and AI didn't replace the fund managers,
where did all that highly anticipated, highly expensive technology actually end up?
Because we know these firms are spending billions on it.
It ended up in the plumbing. And I mean that in the most literal administrative sense.
The back office.
Let's look at tokenization first. The grand vision was that a token would be a judgment tool, that it would vote on fund governance or make strategic asset allocation decisions entirely autonomously.
But the reality recorded in the terminal is that tokenization arrived purely at the settlement layer.
Yes. It's being used to process capital calls, to distribute quarterly payouts, to calculate net asset value.
The sources highlight initiatives like UBS, UMINT, and DTCC Smart NAV.
But we really shouldn't dismiss this as trivial. Automating the movement of money and data at the settlement layer is cutting administrative costs by 40 to 60%.
Wait. How does just moving a digital token cut administrative costs by 60%? What is it actually replacing?
It is replacing multi-party reconciliation.
Meaning humans checking each other's math.
Exactly. In a traditional setup, when a fund calls for capital, the fund's accountant records it, then the bank's accountant verifies it, then the investor's accountant logs it.
Three different ledgers.
Three different human teams reconciling the exact same transaction over days. A tokenized settlement layer operates on a single, shared, immutable ledger.
So the transaction reconciles instantly across all parties.
Yeah. The 60% cost saving comes from eliminating that redundant human verification.
Okay, so tokenization is saving money on accounting. What about artificial intelligence?
Well, the 2025 framework predicted funds would build in-house, end-to-end AI systems.
Right. The idea was that the fund itself would become a native AI brain, scanning the market, picking the targets, executing the deals.
But the terminal data shows a starkly different reality. AI relocated to external platforms.
Like who?
Companies like Juniper Square and Carta built the AI tools, and the fund managers simply rent them as a service.
So the general partner is just the tenant of the technology, not the architect.
Exactly.
So all this buzz about AI transforming high finance, and the reality is that the most prestigious firms in the world are just paying a monthly subscription for fancy admin software.
The data absolutely supports that conclusion. The terminal notes that while 88% of funds report using AI in their daily operations.
88%?
Yes. But only 39% report any actual impact on their earnings, their EBIT, or earnings before interest and taxes.
That is a massive gap. Why are nearly 90% of funds using AI, but only a fraction are actually making more profit from it?
The bottleneck is mundane data hygiene. AI models require clean, structured data to identify profitable patterns.
And fund data is not clean.
The terminal found that the internal data within most private funds is incredibly chaotic. PDFs, mismatched spreadsheets, unstructured emails.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If your underlying data is a mess, the most advanced pattern recognition algorithm in the world cannot generate a profitable investment thesis. It just gets confused.
That really strips away the mystique. But you mentioned they are renting this AI from platforms. The terminal uses a specific phrase for this, the agentic platform turn.
Yes.
What does that actually mean for the industry?
Well, we need to demystify the word agentic first. An AI agent doesn't just answer a prompt like a chatbot. It takes autonomous actions to complete a multi-step goal.
Right. It does the work.
But the crucial part of that phrase is the word platform. The AI agent lives in the software of the platform provider, not within the individual fund.
So the platform is the one getting smarter.
Exactly. The platform is the entity learning how to optimize tax documents, flag compliance issues, and streamline operations across thousands of different funds simultaneously.
The intelligence, and therefore the long-term value, is aggregating at the platform layer.
Completely outside the control of the fund managers.
Because the platforms are learning from everyone's data at once. So if the algorithms aren't autonomously picking the deals, the human managers are still very much in the driver's seat.
Very much so.
But according to this OFP terminal, those humans are currently stuck dealing with a very severe, very human problem. They are essentially running out of cash to give back to their investors.
This is arguably the most critical structural shift documented in the entire terminal. They call it the distribution drought.
It sounds ominous.
It is actively rewriting the entire exit logic of private markets.
Let's break down the mechanics of this drought because the numbers in the report are staggering. The terminal notes that distributions, meaning the actual cash funds are returning to their investors, are currently sitting at roughly 6% of buyout assets under management.
Or AUM.
Just to level set, buyout funds are the ones that purchase entire mature companies. The historical norm for returning cash in that space is 14%.
And that drop from 14 to 6% has created a $3.7 trillion deal dam.
A deal dam is the perfect visualization.
The traditional private equity model relies on a predictable cycle. You buy a company, you hold it and improve it for 3 to 5 years, and then you sell it to realize a profit and return cash to your LPs.
But right now, high interest rates mean buyers cannot afford to borrow the money needed to meet the high asking prices of the sellers.
And the sellers refuse to take a loss. So nobody sells.
The dam holds back the assets. But the LPs, the pension funds and endowments, they still need their cash distributions.
Right, to pay out retirees and fund university operations.
So if the funds can't sell the assets, how are they getting the cash to satisfy the LPs?
They turn to financial engineering. The framework documents a massive surge in alternative liquidity mechanisms, specifically net asset value lending, or NAV lending.
Okay.
Alongside a vehicle known as a continuation fund.
I want to dig into these continuation vehicles because from the outside, the mechanics sound bizarre.
They do sound strange, yeah.
A fund essentially takes an asset that it cannot sell on the open market, and it sells that asset to a brand new fund.
That is managed by the exact same firm.
Right, so they're basically selling the asset to themselves.
That is the precise mechanism. This allows them to generate liquidity to pay out the investors in the older fund who want to leave.
While bringing in new investors for the new fund.
Exactly, allowing the firm to keep managing and charging fees on the underlying asset.
If I'm an investor listening to this, and I hear my fund manager is just passing a company from their left hand to their right hand, or taking out an NAV loan, meaning borrowing money against their own unsold assets just to pay me a distribution.
You'd be concerned.
I'm immediately wondering, how is this not just a sophisticated shell game? Aren't they just creating a flattering illusion of success?
That discomfort you're sensing is the core tension of the current market. The ARCH 2.0 terminal explicitly highlights this as the problem of flattered IRR and DPI figures.
Internal rate of return and distributions to paid in capital.
Right. These are the primary metrics investors use to judge a fund's success. When a fund uses borrowed money to manufacture a distribution, they are masking the true liquidity of the underlying assets.
It's like taking out a home equity loan to pay yourself a salary.
Yeah.
You have cash in your pocket, so it feels like you are making money, but you haven't actually earned new income. You've just borrowed against what you already built.
The home equity loan analogy is close,
but
with a major catch. If you take out a home equity loan, you have a highly liquid, independent housing market that tells the bank exactly what your house is worth.
Oh, right, because houses are sold every day.
With private funds, they are borrowing against an asset where the fund manager is the one dictating the valuation.
That is a huge conflict of interest.
Today's surge in asset-backed lending is just an echo of equity invested years ago. You can only borrow against a book of business that earlier equity actually built.
Which leads directly to what the terminal calls the valuation gap.
Yes.
What the fund claims the company is worth internally might be drastically higher than what the open market would actually pay for it today.
Public market multiples have compressed, but many private valuations have remained suspiciously stable.
Suspicious is a word.
When participants are relying on valuations they cannot independently verify, especially now that retail investors are being brought into the fold through those 40-act funds we discussed, trust begins to erode.
And when trust erodes, the state steps in.
Inevitably. The SEC and independent valuation firms are now being forced to step in as the market's honesty police.
Because the industry can't be trusted to grade its own math, it always comes back to the regulators.
It does.
But because the U.S. and European markets are so bogged down in this liquidity trap, we are actually seeing capital adapt in real time elsewhere. The terminal highlights a massive divergence occurring globally.
Yeah, the West is currently fracturing over climate mandates. The terminal notes that European regulations are hardening,
embedding climate architecture directly into financial compliance.
Exactly. While the U.S. is actively retreating from it, leading to major managers quietly abandoning their climate alignment commitments to avoid political blowback.
No, we are just looking at the structural data here, not weighing in on the politics of those mandates. But the impact on the market is clear.
Very clear. But if you look away from the U.S. and Europe and look at emerging markets, specifically Africa, you don't see the same distribution drought.
The terminal points out that the very nature of who is funding the African market and how they are doing it has completely mutated.
It's a profound structural realignment. Historically, private capital in Africa was heavily anchored by development finance institutions, or DFIs.
These are the government-backed investment arms from developed nations, right? Designed to spur growth in emerging markets.
Correct. But the data shows DFIs have significantly retreated. Their share of African venture capital dropped from roughly 45% down to around 27%.
Why did government-backed entities pull back so hard? Was it just risk aversion?
The terminal points to a combination of rising interest rates, making capital more expensive globally, coupled with shifting political mandates back home.
But the structural consequence of that retreat is what really matters.
Because the vacuum didn't stay empty. It forced domestic capital to mature. Corporate investors and local pension funds stepped up to anchor deals where development finance once stood alone.
By 2025, domestic corporate investors actually became the single largest contributor to Africa venture fundraising.
And a shift in who provides the money entirely changes how the money is deployed.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The terminal calls this the operator shift. As capital became scarce, the investment models didn't get more sophisticated with AI algorithms. They got cruder.
More direct.
Yes. Development lenders and domestic pools started bypassing traditional private equity funds entirely. They cut out the middleman and started funding the operators directly.
The distinction between an operator and a fund is vital to understanding this shift. A traditional fund raises a pool of money based on a thesis.
A promise of the types of companies they will hunt for, buy, and eventually sell over a strict 10-year cycle.
Right. But an operator is an entity that already owns producing tangible assets.
It's the difference between giving money to a guy with a slick PowerPoint about a neighborhood he wants to build versus giving your money directly to a landlord who already owns the apartment building and is actively collecting rent today.
The data completely bears that out. The terminal notes that between 56 and 94% of operator capital revolves and renews itself endlessly with no fixed end date.
They run rolling funding programs.
Continuously borrowing against loan books or solar sleets they already have operational. Compare that to 0% for traditional fund capital, which must be wound down, liquidated, and returned to LPs at the end of the cycle.
The new divide in the market isn't operator versus fund, it is assets that exist versus a thesis.
And OSP calls this a weak signal for a much larger global trend they call function convergence.
What exactly is converging?
The roles within the capital stack. Function convergence suggests that the traditional deal layer in the middle, the private equity fund with its extra layers of middlemen, management fees, and carried interest,
is getting completely squeezed out.
Exactly. The market is splitting into two extremes. Allocators who just want exposure to hard-earning assets, and the operators who run those assets. The intermediary thesis peddler is losing relevance.
And speaking of hard-earning assets, the 2025 framework had a few wild predictions for Africa that actually came true.
But for completely unexpected reasons.
Yeah. They predicted that historically dirty sectors like mining, heavy logistics, and extractives would become highly investable again.
The original prediction was that this revitalization would happen through climate-financed clean upgrades. The thesis was that Western green transition funds would pay for the modernization and decarbonization of these heavy industries.
But the terminal confirms that is not what drove the capital.
Not at all.
No, it wasn't the green transition. These sectors became investable again strictly because of raw U.S. and China geopolitics and the massive energy demands of the AI transition.
The data points are stark. Look at the development of the DRC-Zambia electric vehicle battery corridor, or the massive international funding pouring into the Lobito Corridor Railway.
And even African defense capabilities becoming a target for U.S. venture acquisition.
This capital flow was not driven by environmental, social, and governance mandates. It was driven by resource sovereignty.
The need to secure critical minerals for the tech supply chain and secure the sheer amount of physical energy required to power thousands of new AI data centers.
It completely overrode the climate narratives.
Again, just reporting the data impartially here, but the money flowed to secure the supply chains, not to green them.
It is real politic dictating capital allocation. It forces us to look past the marketing narratives of high finance and focus on the unglamorous mechanics of how the world actually runs.
So what does this all mean? To distill this entire deep dive for you listening, the grand vision of 2030 finance that we were sold a few years ago.
A decentralized, frictionless, AI-ruled utopia where code replaces human negotiation.
Exactly. That is not our reality. The reality documented in the ARCH 2.0 terminal is a world where state regulators and government policies still hold the ultimate power.
Technology, for all its brilliance and hype, has mostly settled into being highly efficient, cost-saving plumbing in the back office.
Furthermore, cash flow remains the undisputed king. The inability of traditional funds to return cash to their investors is forcing incredible financial engineering.
Then fundamentally changing how assets are valued, held, and traded.
And on the global stage, raw geopolitical security and resource sovereignty are trumping purely climate-driven investment mandates.
So the next time you are sitting in a strategy meeting and someone throws around a buzzword like smart contracts, AI native funds, or programmable governance,
you now know the reality behind the curtain.
Yes.
Don't look at the glossy presentation. Look at the plumbing.
Look at what the regulators are doing.
And above all, look at the actual cash flow.
It requires a profound shift in perspective. We must accept that the real drivers of market structure today are not elegant technological innovations, but rather state action, regulatory divergence, and international rivalry.
Which leaves you with a pretty staggering thought to mull over. If the architecture of global capital is actively being rewired by international relations and resource sovereignty rather than software engineering, does that mean the next great financial crash won't be caused by a failure of code, but by a failure of international diplomacy? Something to think about the next time someone promises you that an algorithm can predict the future.